broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of the Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis Van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio is Joel Hewish.
Good morning, Louis.
Good morning, Joel. And Brett Dickinson.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Brett. And on special comments today, we have Hugh Davies.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome, Hugh.
Ooh, this is not round two. I'm grossly underprepared.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Don't worry, so are we.
That's probably why we brought you in.
That's right. We are into December here at the Investor Exchange and getting into the Christmas spirit with various Christmas events, Christmas parties. You might notice my voice is a little more gravelly today, a little more golden.
It was your turn last night.
It was my turn. That's right. I had a nice bit of fun doing some networking and mingling at a function for financial advisors, mainly focused on insurances.
No soft dollar benefits?
No soft dollar benefits at all. No. not $300 worth anyway. But no, it was a good networking function and good to always come together in the financial advice community and just get a sense of what other businesses are doing and how other people are feeling in the industry. And the big news at the moment is around what APRA is doing in the insurance space. So I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, but APRA for the last year has been putting pressure on insurance companies because, well, APRA themselves have come under fire from the regulators coming out of the Royal Commission. So, of course, all the regulators are trying to really jump and be a lot more pushy, flexing their muscle post-Royal Commission. But this actually goes on for more than that period of time. The problem is that in life insurance, you've got life insurance contracts where people have insurance if they pass away, and you've got other lump sum benefits, so the insurer will pay if someone is totally and permanently disabled or has a trauma event. And there's also disability insurance, like income protection insurance, where the insurer will pay a monthly amount for as long as someone is sick or affected by an injury or accident. And the problem with disability insurance is that type of insurance in the last 5 years has lost $3 billion in losses.
So claims have been a big part of that?
It's always that balance between the premiums that come in and the claims that get paid out and the actual costs of running an insurance business.
Wow.
And disability insurance as a business unit across the industry is losing $3 billion in the last 5 years.
That's not sustainable.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And that's what the regulator's concern is. So APRA is not their primary concern is not for consumers. That's more the job of the ACCC and ASIC. But APRA's primary concern is the long-term sustainability of these financial institutions. And so that's why APRA has been saying, look, guys, you got to do something about the way that you are managing your disability insurance books because you're losing too much money and this is not a sustainable way for you to run your industry. So what they've been trying to do is getting individual insurers to change the terms of their insurance contracts to be more favourable to the insurers. And the insurance companies have actually been unwilling to move in that direction because if one insurer starts saying, well, our contract is not so good for the consumer, how many financial advisors are going to send their business to that insurance company?
Close to zero.
Close to zero. It's going to cost them market share.
Mm. Because, I mean, it doesn't make sense to continually want a line of business that you lose money on, but obviously they're making enough money on the other lines of business because of this lead product.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's this argument between letting the market work out what it does, the capitalist way of thinking, mm-hmm. versus the regulator's way of thinking, which is no, we need to intervene and make this sustainable for you. And back in May, APRA gave them what is known as their final warning to do something about it. And since May, what the insurance companies have done is, instead of fixing their profitability and changing any kinds of definitions in their contracts, they've actually gone on a price war.
Gone the other way.
Gone the other way. Let's try and win more market share by being even less profitable and reducing our prices. They've kind of done it in a frustrating way as well. From the advisor's point of view, they've done it through discounts on the first year of premium on new business.
Yeah, right.
Which makes it difficult to compare one insurer versus another. Because when you're comparing, as an advisor, when we're comparing one insurer against another, if one has a 10% discount on the first year of premium and another has no discount on the first year of premium, it means that instead of just looking at one set of prices, I now need to create a matrix of prices that shows the longer term premium rises to take all of those things into account. So it's making my job harder. And for those consumers who do take a policy with a year one discount, what happens in year two and three?
They get a big jump.
They're going to get a huge jump in their insurance premiums. Not just the usual yearly increase, but an additional 10% increase in price over that time. Which again is bad for sustainability for the insurers, because that means that they're going to have a high drop-off rate.
Yeah.
It's all a little bit stupid. So APRA has stepped in and said, no, we're going to intervene, and from the end of March next year, we're going to change the types of insurance contracts that you guys can offer on income protection. So for those in the know, new agreed value contracts on income protection are going to be gone. So that's a big layer of protection for a lot of people. If you've already got a contract, you're fine. Your existing contract stays in place. But for anyone who doesn't have agreed value income protection, get it now and get it before March. Also, there's going to, at the moment, there is something called guaranteed renewable on all insurance contracts, and they're looking at modifying that, so that every 5 years, the insurance company has the ability to reassess the terms of a contract.
Right. Ooh. Okay.
So
5 years isn't a long time.
No, that's right. Yeah. So they won't have the ability to look at a person's medical side of things, but they will have the ability to reassess the individual's occupation and their level of income and other factors around those sorts of things.
All right. So change the level of cover?
Yeah, change the level of cover. So if you have someone who is currently an accountant and they get their income protection contract, and then in 5 years or 10 years' time, they change their career and they decide, actually, I'd like to be a filmmaker, or I'd like to be a physiotherapist, or I'm going to go from my white-collar job to a blue-collar job, the existing insurance contract stays in place and is priced for that person to be an accountant, and that doesn't change.
Okay.
Whereas going forward with this five-year renewal, the insurance company will be able to say, you need to give us your up-to-date information and we will reprice the contract according to your current situation.
Well, that seems reasonable.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. In a way, it does.
Your circumstances have changed.
Yeah. It's a big change from the current concepts. And there hasn't been a change in that type of arrangement since income protection existed from the late 70s or early 80s when this kind of policy was first created.
So who would be the typical people who would go for an agreed policy? And why would you go for an agreed policy?
You'd go for an agreed value policy if your income has the risk of fluctuating or decreasing in future years.
People females taking maternity leave,
yes,
that type of thing.
Correct.
Sales-focused individuals as well.
Yep, sales people who get big commissions. But more than anyone else is business owners, particularly small business owners, because their income will sometimes follow the economic cycle, and they'll have years where their income is good and they'll have years where their income is not good. Mm-hmm. Here's one of the things that will happen as a result, though. When economic times are tough and these business owners' incomes are low, it's statistically shown that there are greater instances of illness from mental illness.
Yeah.
So, right at the time that claims are going to be higher, the regulator is forcing insurers to look at the person's income when it's low. So you're going to have a lot of people whose claim payment is reduced because of the time that they're claiming.
Which is the time when they most need it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you're going to have someone who goes on to a long-term claim at a low amount of income, because their short-term income at the time that they were claiming is at a low point.
Tricky.
It is tricky. It is tricky. So, interesting things happening in the insurance space.
Yeah. Challenging time for it.
Yeah.
Sure, well, the change just never stops in this industry, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Well, it's probably in any industry.
No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Other newsworthy events. Did anyone see what happened at the Westpac AGM?
I'm gathering it wasn't quite pleasant for all of the seniors involved, senior execs.
They've been held to account, Louis?
Well, that's what the news says. The news says there was some pretty furious shareholders, pretty furious that they were holding shares in a company that had avoided their reporting obligations to the regulator and inadvertently been supporting child abuse overseas. So, yeah, people are very upset, and I bet the board members were feeling the heat in their chairs.
Yeah.
And they probably felt like on a night like that they were earning their salary.
Yeah. Would have been uncomfortable.
And there was a lot of shareholders who were saying, no, you don't deserve your salary.
Yeah. I think you get a second strike on their remuneration report.
They did, yes. So from the remuneration report, they've got a second strike, which is a which triggers a full spill of the board, which means everyone has to be re-elected. I think most people did get re-elected. I don't think anyone got voted out.
Surprising, given what's transpired.
Yeah, but a few board members got close to it.
Any shoes being thrown? Any tomatoes?
No, nothing like that.
Get to the good stuff.
Yeah, here's something I didn't realise is that board members get paid their fee for sitting on the board, but they also get paid an additional fee if they sit on any committees.
Right.
In relation to it.
Yep.
So one shareholder pointed out that every member of the board sat on Westpac's risk committee.
Yeah. Right.
So they're earning an extra fee from sitting on that committee, and they all sit on it, and they didn't see this risk.
Well, so they knew it. They just didn't do anything about it. That's the thing. I mean, a lot of these risks were actually identified years ago, and they just had other priorities, like selling loans to people who shouldn't have got them.
Yeah, that's right. So guess what got announced last night? At the AGM, wasn't last night, but what announced was there will be an additional committee called the Financial Crime Committee.
Who's going to be on that?
Shouldn't we have a committee to create committees?
Yeah.
Committee
and,
creation
and a committee. Committee oversight committee.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a good one. I love it.
A committee appointment committee.
Yes. So lots of unhappy shareholders.
How do you get one of those gigs?
At Westpac.
Now, the penalties haven't been issued yet, though, have they? So there's still the financial impacts yet to be known.
Yet to be known, yeah. But the estimates range broadly, with Commonwealth Bank's fine being $700 million. It's well expected this fine will be over $1 billion. And Joel, you've said that some estimates are as high as $3 billion.
This is for
Westpac. You with this job?
No, I was actually thinking about, this sounds very familiar to Teldar Paper, and where you've got...
what's Teldar Paper?
Gordon Gekko gets up and he delivers his famous...
Greed is good. Yes.
And he starts poking fun at all of the directors up on the... on the podium, and he says, you know, I'm trying to figure out what any of you guys do, and I couldn't figure it out, but yet you guys spend so many billion dollars a year on travel and all that sort of stuff, probably sending paper, you know, paper from one director to the other to try and figure out what that director's doing. So, honestly,
life imitates art.
You could take a look at Wall Street and Gordon Gekko's Greed is Good. It's probably a great parallel of Westpac. Yeah.
But just coming back around, Joel, a couple of weeks ago when this first sort of broke, we did touch on what the fines were likely to be, and I do recall you had an article or an estimate there that was around the $3 billion mark.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. I was just
dreaming. Or it might have gotten as high as $3 billion.
It's been a big week, I've got to be honest with you.
I'm winding down for the year.
I'm trying to pull myself together.
Not long to go, mate. Yeah. Just hanging
beginning
there.
To look a lot like Christmas. Joel's on holiday.
One point. In 2012, HSBC had a fine for AML, counter-terrorism financing, some breaches, and that was $2 billion US.
This is HSBC, right? This is about the drug.
And they were allowing about $800 million in the sale of illegal drugs. So. There's precedent. There's a whole lot of stuff. So it'll be big. And you know who ends up paying?
The consumer,
the shareholders, and consumers.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the bosses.
Yes, Joel, tell us what else has been happening.
What else has been happening? I'm rather unprepared for today. I've got to be honest with you. I have had a full week of events, and I'm running on empty.
Just say something controversial then.
He's hanging out with Tiger Woods today.
Yeah, I've got to get out to the bloody President's Cup today. I feel sorry for you,
Paul Wanker.
I got another dinner tonight. I had another dinner last night. The dinner night before that.
Yeah.
What is happening? What's happening in the world? Well, look, you know, we've had Trump and China have been fighting against each other for the last, well, at least Trump's fighting China anyway, for the last 12, 18 months or so.
Yep.
And we've had 3 years of unresolved Brexit, or 3.5 years of almost of unresolved Brexit now. And this week, we could see some major progress on both of those fronts.
Mm-hmm. There's an election at the moment, like right now?
Right now, we have a UK election.
In about an hour, I think the exit polls start coming in. I think it's 10 p.m. UK time. So, votes have been cast. Don't know what the weather was like, because that can be it. Strangely enough, it had a big impact in the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
Young people just went, screw it, I don't want to go out to vote. Don't know what the weather was like in London, but it would have been cold.
It would have been, yeah.
So voter turnout is a big factor, and I guess we'll see what happens. In the next hour or so.
They do it during the week, like every election in Australia is on a Saturday.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the US.
And the US is on
a Saturday.
Tuesday.
It's on a Tuesday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So we're the outlier.
Yeah.
Having our election on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Well, no. we're
how rude. But the UK and the US, they don't have compulsory voting. We have compulsory voting, so having it during the week,
that would shut everything down.
Too hard.
So we could find out today whether or not the Tories or Labour or even the Liberal Democrats could get into power. I don't think Liberal Democrats are really half a chance, but I think the primary reason why we're going to this election is because Brexit has been just a stalemate. So now it's okay. We need to see if something can get this moving or get something decided.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson was the one who was very much pushing for an early election, and he got it. And if he is hoping for a majority that will allow him to just pass through Brexit without actually having to do any negotiation or deals with non-leavers. So we'll see what happens, but we could have some big steps, or we could just have the same 3.5 years
or you could just keep going on not knowing what's going on.
Nothingness.
Yeah.
And I think, look, ultimately, for businesses, I think they don't really, I think they're at the point now where the sentiment is they don't really care whether they leave or they stay. They just want to know what the decision is.
Yep.
And I think that for we're seeing the same type of sentiment when it comes to the US and the China trade deal as well. I think everyone's now sick and tired of all of this. You know, Trump's going to get a deal done. No, he's not going to get a deal done. He woke up on the wrong side of the bed today. No, he woke up on the right side of the bed. We just want to know what the new environment's going to be. And if it's going to be something different to what it was previously, well, let us adapt to it. You know, eventually we will adapt. Businesses will adapt. Consumers will adapt. They'll find new ways of being able to overcome the tariffs that are in place. New technology will end up bringing the cost down in some form or another. But we just need to know what the new rules are. So we also have Trump. Just this morning, we've got an announcement that there is a phase one trade deal that has been reached in principle. And currently, it is sitting with the Donald to either ratify or to deny that phase one trade deal. So Friday night tonight could be a big night on the stock market. It could be a big up, a lot of ways, could be a big down. Could be quite volatile, put it that way.
So you're going to stay up all night and watch, Joel?
No.
No.
No, I think the Donald would be still asleep right now. No, sorry, I got the wrong time zone. Yeah, so no, he'd be awake. It'd be the afternoon over there.
Yep.
So, yeah, we'll see what happens. Mm. Exciting times. Exciting times. Now, I don't know if you guys have all... are you guys art buffs? You
follow Not particularly.
No.
I don't know if you've heard the news lately, but... there is a Art Basel Miami Beach show. It's an art show held over in Miami, and it's a modern art show. And apparently, bananas are now worth $120,000 a piece.
Is this a you can't be serious? I did see this.
Well, I thought about bringing it as a you can't be serious, but I think that it requires a little bit more of a discussion around it, because the actual story behind it gets even more and more bizarre. So there's three bananas stuck together on a wall in this art gallery in Miami with duct tape. And each one of them sold for $120,000. Now, this was a Maurizio Catalan.
Didn't someone eat one?
And then a performer came up and ate it.
My God.
Creating all sorts of controversy. But even the... but I mean, why would you pay $120,000 for a banana stuck to a wall
in this
place? Because it'll be off in 3 days. What are you going to do with it?
You got way too much money spending that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, it gets even more bizarre because it created so much interest from the general public that they've now had to shut down the display because it was creating a health and safety concern. Because of the crowds that were gathering around banana.
Oh, my God.
So, I tell you what. No
banana peels on the floor.
Yeah.
They need to come to Australia and visit the big banana.
So, forget trading in stocks. Apparently, all you need is a banana and a piece of duct tape, and you can make yourself $120,000.
So, do we know how that's going to play out? The guy that ate the banana, is he up for the cost of it or what?
No, so apparently this is even more bizarre. So apparently the gallery said it's not about that banana, it's about the idea of the banana.
Okay.
So, oh, it's my the God. Idea that counts. That's worth
$120,000.
The world's gone banana.
Well, it's gone mad. It's off the wall.
It's really the perfect piece of performance art, because the whole concept of art is that it reflects life and life happens, and this is just what has happened to a particular piece of art, which is art in itself.
Well,
isn't it?
These crazy things, many people talk about when you're getting close to a top in the financial markets, that crazy things start to happen, right? You know, people who have made too much money start spending money on crazy things that make no logical sense.
We've now got the banana indicator.
So maybe this could be, I mean, look, I don't know. I don't think we're close to a top, but perhaps we're close to a correction, because this could be exactly like Brett said.
A leading indicator. We're going bananas.
And that ties in nicely with what is an extraordinary valuation for a new company, or for an old company that's now listed on the stock market. The world's largest publicly listed company comes with a valuation of $2 trillion. Now, does anyone know who this might be?
Wow.
Almost twice the size of Amazon and Microsoft and Apple.
Yep.
It's one Apple, one Microsoft. It would be Saudi Aramco.
Saudi Aramco. Yes,
I have read about this. Tell us more.
So, it's just had its second day of trading on the stock market in Saudi Arabia. It's actually not listed on the US, but it comes with a US devaluation of $2 trillion.
Wow.
So, it's had a pretty good first couple of days of trading, listed for a valuation of around about 1.8 trillion, and in the first few days of trading has got up to 2 trillion, although it has retreated slightly in the last few days. So,
jeez.
Got a lot of money flushing around in the financial markets this week.
And just tell us what kind of company it is, just by comparison.
It is an oil and it's an oil company.
It's the
Saudi state-owned energy company.
Yep.
That runs all of their oil-producing oil fields and is basically an integrated... vertically integrated energy company. Yeah. So, they do everything from extracting it out of the grounds, prospecting, refining, manufacturing, exporting, all of that stuff.
So, would they have the biggest reserves on the planet?
I believe they do.
I believe they do, but a big part of this IPO is very much around removing their reliability on oil, because that's their number one export.
That's right.
So they are, and they understand that they need to diversify away. So they're also one of the biggest investors in SoftBank.
Who
got a few things wrong recently.
The famous investors behind Uber and WeWork
and just about any other technology.
Another high dump dud coming to you.
Yeah.
So they're investing. So now they've got it's a $2 trillion valuation. I think they sold 22% or 25% of the company is now public. So,
yep. So who owns the remainder? The state.
The state,
Crown Prince.
And
Mohammed bin Salman.
Yeah, so expect that all of that money is going to go into one place.
So if
it's going to be equities, and it's probably going to be technology driven, and there's going to be a lot of money going into startup, venture capital style things.
That's half a trillion dollars that they've raised in cash. That they're now going to be reinvesting somewhere.
Yeah, and I think that they actually have plans to float more of that that stock. So their whole vision to float Saudi Aramco was to be able to, like what you said, diversify the economy of the Saudis, and by putting it into and investing in new technologies and making Saudi a player in many other industries, not just in the oil and energy sector.
And am I right in what I heard that you said 3/4 is still owned by a particular person? Could you claim that?
The Crown Prince.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a sovereign asset, but the prince, the royal family, control the sovereign asset. So
that would make him the wealthiest so far over anyone else. If it's valued at $2 trillion,
it's attributable to
the family.
Him.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but you're right. It must make him.
I mean, you hear about Buffett and Co. being in the 50 to 100 million range.
Billion,
for him to be at the $1.5 trillion, if that's the way you calculate it.
That's right. That's amazing.
Massive.
We will cut to a break. We'll be back with you shortly with more.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And hello again. Brett, let's hand it over to you.
Sure. I had something catch my eye this week. Several things have been catching my eye this week.
You better go and get that checked out.
but this article was in regard to how do we compare globally in terms of cost of housing and rental versus ownership of property. So we obviously talk about the Australian residential market, and sometimes we compare that with some of the international markets. But this particular report was done by Swinton, which are a UK insurance company. So a lot of the information is UK based, but they've compared it with the rest of the world on a number of factors. So the main thing that they led with was how 56% of Brits want to buy their own home to give them a sense of security. Yet over the last 10 years, home ownership in the UK has dropped 11%. So there's more renters than owners. And they've got some really interesting data here. So they're using a comparison of the cost of ownership versus renting, and they're using it against average wages. And they also do the cost of owning on a square meter rate.
Right.
So a few things that popped out of this that I thought was fascinating. So in the UK, the average size of a dwelling these days, so this is houses and apartments, an average size of 71.9 square meters.
Okay.
Right.
So when people are talking about housing affordability and they say, oh, a house in the UK is £200,000 or £300,000, Australia's median's getting up towards 800 or whatever we're talking there, it's hard to compare apples with apples because the Australian average dwelling size is 186 square metres.
Yeah, right.
So it's more than double.
Bigger, yeah.
Yeah. And Australia are the second biggest housing size on the planet behind America.
Right.
So therefore, just doing an average house price or an average dwelling price is probably not a fair comparison because there's so many variables in that as well. So they've used a square metre rate to ascertain whether it's better to rent versus own in certain countries.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that that stood out, the most significant change in our home ownership over the last 10 years, well, Australia lead the way where we've had an increase of renters becoming owners of 86% in that time.
Oh, wow.
Right.
So okay. we're far and way above any of the other countries in terms of that growth. Poland is the next one at 35%. And then on the other end of the scale, you've got the UK and Ireland that have dropped 11%.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously, if you're only looking at the Australian market and you're listening to the Australian media, you're hearing about how unaffordable we're getting and how hard it is to get onto the property market.
Yep.
Well, it's actually tougher in a lot of other countries. And the one that seems to be the most difficult, and they have the highest percentage of renters, anyone know which country? And they're known to have a high cost of living, which is part of the reason.
Hong Kong.
No, it's actually Switzerland.
Oh, really? Right.
Switzerland has the lowest.
Somewhere in Europe.
Yeah, has the lowest amount of home ownership and the highest amount of renters. Right. And a lot of that is because just their day-to-day living costs are so high. Their wages are high, but because their living costs are so high, people are choosing lifestyle and benefits like that rather than locking away so much money in a property.
Yeah, I see. Mm. Their form of renting, though, is a lot more secure than our form of renting here in Australia.
I don't know enough about that, Louis. Yeah.
I don't know about Switzerland specifically, but I know that in Europe in general, that when you are a tenant and you are renting, it's common for people to live in the same place for 5 years, 10 years on long-term rental agreements. And I think it's similar in places New York City as well.
Yeah.
You'll have someone who takes up a three-year lease with an option for more years on the end of it.
Mm. And those changes are likely to come here.
You think so?
Yeah. I remember going to an event roughly 12 months ago where there was an overhaul of the Residential Tenancies Act,
and
they were talking about allowing longer term. So there was about four or five significant changes. One of them was making leases longer term and giving the tenants more ability to customize a home, so to be able to paint or hang things on the wall without, you know, too many consequences.
Yep.
Because I guess it was the landlords have sort of had their way in saying, well, we want protection against this and, you know, higher bonds and whatever else to protect their asset, which is fair and reasonable.
Yep.
But then the other tenants have hit back and said, well, hang on, if we're the ones paying all this and we're giving you the income, we want, you know, more security of our position too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's difficult to be a long-term renter in Australia when you have an end date when your lease expires. That happens usually every year, and you can be kicked out on 90 days notice.
Yeah. And you don't have an ability to extend if the landlord doesn't want you to.
Yeah. So it's not immediate, but if the landlord changes their minds, well, then you're out and your family's out.
Yeah.
Which is why, or part of the factors that mean that people want to own their houses in Australia.
Yep. So we seem to, on global terms, we seem to be pretty much leading the way in terms of people that want to own their own home.
Well, so it's not all so bad.
Well, interestingly, though, I wouldn't have picked this as the country, but the most expensive country to buy property on the metric that this report brought out, which is square meter rates against wages, was actually the Czech Republic.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
The Czech Republic.
Czech Republic. So over there, it costs three times the monthly salary to buy one square meter. Because remember, they're using square meters as
relative to income.
Relative to income. Right. So they're looking at, you know, square meter prices of homes against your monthly wage.
Right.
And that's the ratio. So Australia's average price of homes may still be higher, but obviously, our homes are significantly bigger. So that's why the ratio has been done this way. So yeah, they're saying that the average monthly salary in the Czech Republic is €872, and one square meter of residential property is €2,600. And France is also costly at 2.7 times the monthly salary. I should have the stat here for Australia. I'll have to dig that up. But yeah, so they were the most expensive. Guess who was the cheapest? I'm not surprised by this.
Brazil?
No, it's...
Oh, the USA.
Of course. Yep.
USA.
Yep.
Lots of land.
Yep, lots of land.
And a proportion of the population with very high incomes.
Very high incomes, yep. Correct. So over there, the monthly salary is €2,500, and one square meter costs €1,800, so the other way.
Right. There you go.
So, you know, obviously, when we're only looking at our own market and we start to think housing is quite expensive here in Australia, well, on global terms, we're not that bad.
Mm.
We've got big dwellings and, you know, we love our backyards and our big living areas. And the one other stat I did see is that the average size of an Australian dwelling has continued to grow.
Right.
Has it?
Yes.
Really?
It's getting much smaller.
Well, land sizes, yes, but dwelling sizes, no.
Ah, okay.
So, interestingly, yes, we're losing a lot of backyards. We're getting more apartments and townhouses, but the sizes of the townhouses and apartments, and of course the houses, are actually growing in terms of where they were 30 years ago.
Yeah. Mm. You see that in housing estates. They build, they'll often have an adjoining garage wall or something.
Yeah.
Or built right on top of each other. And there's only a 1 meter corridor down one side of the house. They're just maximizing the size of the house,
size
on the block.
The building, yeah, and two-story and even sometimes three-story dwellings and townhouses in hill areas.
Yep.
So dwelling sizes are still significantly large. Land sizes are compressing, though.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's take it to another break.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on, or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Let me ask you guys a question. In the Christmas spirit, in the financial Christmas spirit, as we are in this podcast, is Santa a rich man or a poor man?
Ooh. He'd be a very wealthy man.
Oh, yeah, I would say he'd be wealthy.
Why do you say that?
Well, look at all the toys that he's making.
Yeah, he owns the North Pole.
He must have.
He's got a sleigh that can travel around the world.
That's priceless.
Every single house.
Yeah. He's got flying reindeer. I mean, how much are they worth?
And he does a nice thing.
Yeah.
But none of it's his.
Isn't it? I don't know.
Well, all the toys.
They come for free.
Yeah, they're free.
Yeah, of course.
Yep. And he doesn't actually have any money.
No. Well, there's no economy on the North Pole, is there?
No. He uses slaves, though. He's got the other.
So there's something going on.
So he's a.
So I guess, how do we measure? How do we measure the wealth of Santa?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. The point of what I'm getting at is, does he get a royalty?
What is the point? He's getting a royalty from every piece of tinsel sold, from every Christmas, anything every, with Christmas in it, every anything with Santa.
Coca-Cola's cutting him a check.
Yeah. He just gets royalties.
So all those red hats?
Nah, he's got the coal mine out the back as well.
Yeah.
Where else do you think he's getting all of his charcoal from?
That's right.
So my point is there are a lot of self-help books written, and a lot of them in the financial space. And the ones which always interest me and the ones which a lot of them come back to is mindset. The later books that have been a bit more trendy, like The Secret.
Yeah,
if remember that one? Book had a big craze, and Oprah Winfrey promoted it when it came out a few years ago. But it's based on the same shit that's been around for 100 years.
Yeah.
If you go back to the biggest original book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, it's got principles of financial success. And there's a whole host of other ones as well. The Richest Man in Babylon. One of my favorites is Secrets of the Millionaire Mind. It all comes down to mindset. So there's these financial actions that we take, but more importantly, there are financial habits that we pick up, and there are ways that we operate. And giving is one of the biggest things that we can do in our financial mindset. And that's why Santa is one of the richest people around. Because Santa is the biggest giver in the world. This is assuming Santa's a real person. Of course he is.
Kids, earmuffs.
That's right. And all he does is give, and he gives, gives, gives. And he has this infinite giving. So what do you think Santa's mindset is?
Abundance.
Absolute abundance. Yeah. Everything that comes in, I'm just going to give it out.
Because there's so much more.
And the more that Santa gives, he just manages to get more coming in. Who knows where it comes from? He's got these elves that volunteer. They're volunteers, not Joel, not slaves.
Well, there might be an elf committee coming.
Let's go and speak to their union, eh?
Yeah.
And he is donated all these raw materials that his volunteer elves then assemble in their factory. And for all of us, I think if we adopt a giving mentality, then we can adopt that into our way of thinking about finances. So if someone is in retreat, if someone has a small mind mentality around their finances, then they might be thinking, I don't have enough money, and I'm governed by the fear of losing my money, and I'm not going to make big financial decisions because I'm really just trying to hold on to what I've got. One of the results of that is to say, look, I don't have enough money to give at Christmas time. So I'm not going to give to charities. I'm going to give some presents, but they're going to be small presents because I don't have much money to give. A great way to smash that mindset is to give big. As soon as you make a big gift or a big donation, what does that do to a mindset? Well, the mindset totally turns around to saying, well, hang on, I do have enough money to support this giving. and it's going to come back around to me, and it opens up the mindset to looking for growth. Where is my next money opportunity to get a pay rise or to make a good investment so that when it comes around to next year, I can give again? So where am I looking for improvement in my financial resources? Because I am such a giver, I've got enough to give, which then feeds in a feedback loop. I give, therefore I get more money coming in, which means I give more out, which means I get more coming in. And that's a mindset which giving fosters. So at Christmas time, remember to give big. And it's okay to give just a little bit more than you're comfortable with.
So that's the challenge, I think, sometimes, Louis, is to try and have that abundance mindset, though, in order to feel comfortable about the giving.
Yep.
Because sometimes you feel like, oh, I'm giving more than I feel like I should or could. You know, sometimes you just, yeah, what happens first, the giving first or the mindset first?
Well, tough one. Chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
And the thing to do is to start at the scale that you can.
Yeah.
So for some people, a gift of $5 is going to stretch them because they're counting every dollar every week. Mm-hmm. But if you start with that, well, then it triggers that change in mindset. And it is a feedback loop which amplifies. So if you're starting small, I say the same thing about your own savings habit. It's about the habit and the mindset of it. If you're saving into your own bank account, it doesn't matter if you start with $5 a month, but you get into the savings habit of having a regular payment going into your savings accounts. And the same thing goes with giving. It doesn't matter if it's $5 or $10 every Christmas time. And if you can make it more regular, then even better. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a monthly payment of $5 that goes towards a charity, then it's part of your mindset and you're looking at, well, hey, I'm a giver now. How can I give $6 next month? How can I increase it to $10? And you start to become a lot more aware of these money-making opportunities and much more open to learning new things and learning new skills, which then result to more financial success, which then feeds in to your own saving and your own giving. It's all part of the wealth mindset and the growth mindset.
Very good. Very good.
So don't forget to give.
Indeed.
There you go.
Okay.
What's next, fellas?
Are we under this section?
Are we there yet?
We're there.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Woo.
Let's go. Who has a you can't be serious for the day?
I do. Surprise.
I got one.
I found one.
Well, I think this one could be of interest to the three of you guys and to anyone else that may be thinking about a way to earn more money next year or maybe a side hustle or a change of career.
Yeah.
What if there was a job that would pay you around $50,000 a year just to smoke dope?
You cannot be serious!
Sounds all right, eh? Pretty chilled sort of job.
That's but, right.
So,
but how many Big Macs does $50,000 buy?
Well, I guess they don't cover expenses as well. But all the weed's free.
Wow.
So it's a US medicinal cannabis company, and it's a real job. They're offering a reviewer $36,000. So the company American Marijuana looking for an individual with a love for weed to review their products.
Wow.
So the job will include, you have to be fairly apt at doing video reviews and feedback. So you've got to do unboxing of how the product comes and review how it affects you and a few other things. But I would imagine they will have a bucket load of candidates for that.
I would say so.
A lot of candidates, but a lot of them might not get off the couch.
Yes,
eventually.
Through the reviews.
Was it Naomi Campbell? I don't get out of bed for less than
$30,000.
Most dope smokers don't get out of bed.
Well, the only caveat is the reviewer has to live in a state in America or Canada where medicinal cannabis has been legalized.
Right.
There you go.
So there is a filter.
Okay. Fair enough.
How about this person for a employee or a colleague? A Subway employee, Larina Ariana Marin, told police that she robbed her Subway to teach her employee colleagues a lesson.
You cannot be serious!
About how dangerous where they were working could be.
Oh, what a
beautiful.
Yeah, so anyway.
True role play.
She's locked up now.
That's a new training regime.
Yeah. What are we going to do here, Joel?
Well, it reminds me. I actually had when I was working at an establishment out in the Diamond Valley when I was, going through university. One of the security guards ended up armed robbing the place. We had really good time with this security guard and his. Constituents, say we used to go out and have drinks on a Friday night after we'd finish a late night behind the public bar, and sure enough, he stuck up quite a few of the people that he went drinking with.
Oh. You cannot be serious!
Wow, there you go.
I don't think
he was doing it to teach them a lesson.
So perhaps Westpac's problems aren't actually a problem. It's just their training, their AML training.
Yeah.
It's just very extensive.
Yeah, it's just a big drill.
Hugh, do you have anything?
I do. So yeah, you read a lot about internet trolls and keyboard warriors hiding behind the screen not really.
Taking pot shots.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this guy has taken it to another level. There was a vegan protest outside Sydney Town Hall, and he decided to troll them, walked into the middle of the protest with a big box of KFC chicken.
Oh.
And ate it.
Yeah. Be serious!
And that got a massive amount of views, didn't it?
It's gone viral, and he's going around, trending around the world. And,
Yeah.
Very ballsy.
I did see that. It was quite funny. He just walked out there, stood in front of them with his big box and just kept shoving it in.
Wow.
Tasty wings.
Yeah. Oh, if the smell of anything is going to make you want to eat meat, it's probably KFC. There's nothing quite like it.
Herbs and spices.
Oh, jeez. Not a share in our portfolio,
but
it's addictive like crack. Mm. Anyway, thanks, listeners. We made it through another episode. Well done, guys.
Yay.
We're struggling. We're limping to the finish line.
We'll get there.
There's a distinct lack of energy in the air today. We're getting there.
Just wait for next week.
Yeah.
I'm waiting to see. We'll just be mumbling and drooling out one side of our mouths by then.
Can't wait.
All right. Catch you guys then.
Ciao.
Cheers.